You know, a little bit about myself and my story. You know, my name is Alfred Rivera, and I was an individual that was wrongfully convicted in the state of North Carolina for placed and sentenced to death and on North Carolina's death row, and spent nearly 2 years there after being exonerated and released after that. And experiencing, you know, the legal system and its flaws in North Carolina, and, you know, and living through it at such a, you know, a level of, you know, capital punishment, you know, and prior to that and even after that, I also experienced the legal system as far as, you know, the criminal legal system and the ills attached to it, stuff like that. You know, currently, you know, I work along with an organization in North Carolina, the North Carolina Coalition for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. You know, an organization that's committed to abolishment and alternatives. You know, so you know, that's what I'm currently active in.
Is that organization working to stop executions also? That for the people that are currently on death row.
Right. Yes, that's a part of the push of the organization. Also, right now, North Carolina is experiencing a sort of a halt in executions. It's been 16 years since the last execution in North Carolina, based on, you know, legal issues that doesn't allow the courts to actually, you know, impose. I mean, well, they still impose, but no one has been executed in 16 years based on, you know, the law that's being sifted out and gone through. So.
Was you at Central Prison by chance?
Yes. Yeah, I was at Central Prison. Yeah, from 1997 to 1999. Yeah, I was at Central Prison in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Okay, yeah, I know several gentlemen that are there that I have contact with. So could you talk a little bit about how it happened you were exonerated? Because that's a pretty remarkable thing.
Right. Well, in my case, I was convicted of in a murder of two individuals that three co-defendants had implicated myself in and testified together that, you know, that I had committed these crimes along with them. And I was convicted on that. And like I said, I spent nearly 2 years on death row until the Supreme Court of North Carolina overturned the conviction and granted me a new trial, and went back to trial and was acquitted and then released. And you know, that was the, you know, in a nutshell, that was the scenario that landed me with a wrongful conviction, and then thereafter being exonerated, and that was, you know, nearly 1997 I was convicted, and in 1999 I was acquitted, and then in 2000 I was rearrested on federal drug charges and spent nearly 19 years in federal prison after that. So that was, you know, this part of my story
question.
Also,
when you was exonerated and you came out, was there any type of counseling offered to you? I mean, it's a really traumatic thing to receive a death sentence,
right?
And to live there for 2 years, the stress and post-traumatic trauma that went on there. Did they do anything at all to prepare you to come home?
No, in that sense, no, they, nothing at all. No counseling, no compensation, nothing of the sort in my case. And in many cases, and that's just, and that's something that, you know, individual would have to fight for on the, you know, legal terms and issues, you know, just to even get, you know, financial help, for instance, but even to be offered anything from the state after such an ordeal, nothing was in place or is in place to ensure that you know is something that an individual has access to. In my case, I didn't receive nothing whatsoever. So you know, to answer that question, no. Nothing is you know offered in mm-hmm. a sense to take care of that, no.
And when you were sentenced the first time, was there any evidence other than your co-defendants talking?
No. There was no evidence in that sense to that connect me to that crime. Other than the, you know, statements that were given and by the co-defendants, and you know, that was basically it. There was, as far as any other thing, anything beside that was presented, no.
There was, and that's one of the things I'm sure that is addressed by your office when things like this come up, because you know, you're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty beyond any reasonable doubt. And without actual evidence, you know, it seems like there are more cases like this that happen than should.
Right, but see what happens in the scenarios of, you know, lower income or poverty-based communities and things of this nature here, what happens is we're more susceptible to the you know the injustices, like to be targeted, for instance, or to be looked at as possibly always being, you know, capable of crime and things of this nature. So it becomes like easy for law enforcement or district attorneys to, you know, make a claim against an individual with such a background, as far as, you know, whether it's, you know, being poor, underprivileged, and things like this, just because of the environments and the, you know, the constant, you know, pain and poverty that's being dealt with. And people like this, we have to understand these communities and the people that live in from these communities are targeted, you know, in a sense to where's to increase the prison population, mass incarceration, and things of this nature here. All of this is a, you know, racism, you know, racist cops working on the police forces and things of this nature, patrolling neighborhoods that they don't understand, and people that don't understand, cultures and traditions that they don't understand. All of these has to be taken into consideration when you looking at how someone as myself would end up in a position, you know, to be even, you know, wrongly convicted and sent to death row. And not just myself, but others that have been accused and proven to have been, you know, or exonerated and proven to have been innocent. When we look at these cases, we try to understand how and why is this possible in such a nation, you know, as America and the states that we live in America. And we have to, you know, remember and can't forget that these issues play a major part in how something like this can happen. And that's, you know, more than half of the problem. So yeah, for me to end up no, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Nope, I was going to ask if you thought that if we had more persons of color and that came from poorer backgrounds in our leadership roles, if that would increase the chances for those who come from those areas?
Oh yeah, most definitely, because we understand what's needed. And once we, because we understand that once we get a chance to be heard and to lead or put in a position to make a difference, you know, instead of, you know, always being oppressed in a sense to where we can't make a difference or being looked at or being slighted in a way to where we can't make a difference. You know, once we correct these type of things here, then we can, you know, fix. I'm sorry about that. One second. You know, we can, you know, try attempt to understand and fix what actually is really going on, and in the legal system in our communities or with law enforcement, because we'll have a good idea of why these type of situations happen to individuals of color, and why they're being excluded from positions of, you know, leadership and guidance and getting and even you know, positions of you know, consult, you know, being consultation, because in order to understand the root cause of a problem, you know, you have to get to, you know, the in this case, in the case of injustice and racism in America, you have to get it from the communities or the people that's being affected. You see,
that's where the lived experience really comes in, and
right.
I think that even Department of Corrections is starting to realize now that the people that have been there are the ones that can help solve the problems because they have lived it.
Right. And that's why, for instance, you know, I'm glad you brought that up. Because, you know, I mean, that's a true statement because, you know, while I was incarcerated at one point, it came a time when I was able to be in a position of a sort of leadership and, you know, a role model type role, and to be able to share that and use that to influence others, you know, and would be, you know, be counsel and tutor and things. We were given chances to do that when we were able to, you know, first better ourselves and then put in these positions to use that same transformative, you know, stuff, and then, you know, use it amongst our peers, and it worked, you know, because they were influenced, not by the, you know, reputation of an individual or something like that, or as a, you know, being, you know, as far as, you know, the prison environment, you know, toughness and things that they were influenced by. The transformation itself, and how that transformation or the information that allowed that transformation was now given to them in such a way that they could relate to. You see?
Well, and I think it too, it's right. Used in the same language.
Right.
You know, like there's a different language that happens within a facility of right. Any type of culture.
Right.
You know? Right. So that's what a lot of things happen in prison is you have a different culture, you have a different language, right. And that all has to change from within.
Exactly.
You know, right. It's actually the people that are there that need to make the change, that are housed right. There, you know.
Right.
But they're the last ones that are given the opportunity to do that.
And it's just like that in society.
Yes.
The downtrodden of society, the lower so-called lower class of the society and communities are not given an adequate chance in order to compete or to show and make a difference in those areas that they actually can be the difference makers in. So this is part of, you know, again, the broader problem.
I'm curious how you came about to go to work for the North Carolina Coalition for Alternatives to the Death Penalty.
That came about after, you know, my ordeal as far as exoneration. I attempted to get involved, but issues such as what you asked the question about as far as the trauma and counseling, I didn't know at that time that, you know, how affected I was by that situation, in the sense that, you know, without without counseling, I wasn't able to understand that, of course. I just come to understand that, decades later, by other methods, you know, that can be considered as, not the traditional counseling way that we would think of with counselors, but other methods, like while I was incarcerated, I used methods such as spirituality or different things like that to actually give me a sense of purpose. And then, you know, learning how to use that to be able to reflect and to understand, the broader purpose of life itself. And these things were able to give me, in my personal case, as me as an individual, to give me insight into the actual things that caused, my, life to be in the way that it was, or to spiral out of course. I was able to start to see things, by reflecting what, how this could even happen, these things that were happening in my life. And, so my counseling came from that. And because I didn't have it, I was reincarcerated quickly, and I didn't have it when I was in, prior to being incarcerated. And then, while I was incarcerated, those sort of things weren't available. So I had to figure out a way to understand my condition, and, just use what was around me, people that I talked to, other, individuals that were incarcerated that, used the psychology department, just go there and just have a little, and sit around and have sessions and talk. But it wasn't in the sense of, what someone would have a psychiatrist or something like that. So, I was just fortunate enough to be able to, even have that type of space, even though I was, in an unfortunate situation. So
was there any preparation for when you came out the second time? Did they do any type of reentry programming, housing, job perspectives, or anything like that?
Well, the bare minimum is done as far as reentry. What I mean by that is that the paperwork part of the counselor prior to the individual being released is done. But as far as anything that will make a real difference with the individual, my experience and that part of my experience, being incarcerated and stuff, I've never seen anything that, unless the individual is hard at work him or herself, I haven't seen anything that could really, because the recidivism rate is so high that what I'm trying to say is already proven, meaning that the reentry aspect of incarceration and being released is not sufficient enough at this point to bring that number, for instance, down of recidivism. So the discussion is really can be just limited to that, on that question, because it's apparent what's really going on.
Right. So definitely still a lack of programming there, like right, in so many states.
A lack of true guidance, a lack of true help, a lack of support.
How about outside volunteers, like religious volunteers, or I don't hear a lot of outside people coming in. Did you see very much of that?
Not very much, but at times there are occasions or events that would allow for the institutions to bring or to have that type of thing going on, but not in a sense where it would actually, or it's actually making a difference. As far as I just believe, overall that the reason why the states and the state systems and the federal system and the so-called departments of corrections, that it's all a failure because it's been designed a certain way and it's still actually existing like that. There's, the outside help and even the help that individuals may need, when they do end up in a bad position and end up in prison. It's not, that system has not changed. So these things that are set up are things that's been set up already that really not working and need to be changed in a drastic way. And led, by people like the issue you brought up as far as the people that has the direct experience or can give insight on what may need to be done. So until we do that and target, that, until that becomes our aim, then we'll continue to have discussions about why, things are haven't changed, or why is the people being incarcerated at certain rates, or why people the recidivism rates are so high, and why the reentry things are not working, or why the contacts, these things will continue to be an issue because we need to, really make that big change that's needed, and the people that's as myself need to be those that help bring that change about.
So now, in your position where you're at work now, what is your main focus of what your job is there? Because you do outside work also, correct?
Right.
You have another job.
Yeah. So my main focus is just to be a voice as to the realities of a individual that has experienced the injustices of the system here in North Carolina. So, my voice, and also to help formulate ways of action, towards that goal of abolition and change. And how it came about that is because, I attempted to be involved in this work at an earlier state, but because of my psychological, the trauma associated with it, I went back to, the things that I knew of, and just the bad crowds, using drugs again, and stuff like that, and drinking and hanging out, and got reincarcerated and end up spending a lot of time back in prison. And then learning, during that time that, my faults in that. And upon, being released and from that second incarceration after my exoneration from death row, knowing that I had to find a way to make a difference. And, I basically, reached out, and people reached out to me, and knew that there was a possibility that I wanted to get back involved with that, even though I had made my own mistakes. And, you know, they knew that, you know, I had expressed that in the past, that this is something that I would have wanted to do rather than be a person that's, you know, continuing to get locked up and getting in trouble, you know. So I had, you know, a chance to do that now, you know, and knowing that, you know, my voice and my story and the experiences, and to be able to share that in a way that lets people know just a little bit more of what really is going on. So that's why I do the work.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time today to talk to us about, you know, the work that you're doing and your experience and your life, because I know that a lot of people come home and the last thing they ever want to talk about again is prison.
Right.
And we really need those voices, you
right,
know.
Right, right.
Is there any thoughts or messages you might give to somebody that may be sitting on death row in North Carolina right now?
Oh, yeah. You know, the first thing I would, you know, want is for them to, you know, stay free inside as far as being able to, you know, still live on the inside. You know, and I would want them to know that individuals such as myself, no matter how loud or not loud, I would say, if when you don't hear anything, that we're still here on their side, as far as wanting change and wanting second chances in a sense for you know, and wanting people to be treated humanely and wanting people to be you know, have injustices overturned and things of this nature. So if they're sitting there and as they are and as I was, and you know, just to know that, you know, they're not forgotten, that these injustices that exist, that that affects everyone on death row, and will be continue to be fought against, and that you know, the organizations and people on the outside do the work because of them and for them. So this is what I would want them to know.
Well, thank you so much. I want to remind everyone that we've been talking with Alfred Rivera. I'd like to thank you again for joining us on the Prison Pod, because your voice really does matter, and I'm glad that you took the time to share it with us today.
And I thank you for having me, and I really appreciate the chance to, you know, share my voice. And I hope that everyone that gets to hear this really appreciates, you know, what we do as far as to get, you know, these type of voices out. So I thank you all.
Okay, well, I'm going to wind things down. We've been here today with you on the Prison Pod. I want to remind you that this is for you, and your topics, ideas, thoughts, and comments, we want to hear from you. So feel free to write us at any time at the Prison Pod, Post Office Box 294, Orono, Maine, 04473.